This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients, like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Eric. I'm a PhD candidate at the City University of New York Graduate Center. And I research the extraction of fish, pearls, sponges, and oil off the coast of southeastern Arabia.
Glad to have you here, Scott. And today we are here to talk to Professor Steve Mintz, who is a professor of English at St. John's University in New York City. His academic expertise include environmental criticism, the blue humanities, Shakespeare studies, early modern European poetry, and critical theory. He has published 5 single-authored books, including most recently Ocean, published in 2020, Breakup, The Anthropocene, published in 2019, The Shipwreck Modernity, published in 2015. He has edited and co-edited 6 other volumes, published many chapters and articles in scholarly journals and collections, and organized exhibitions and symposia on blue humanities topics. His research has been funded by the Rachel Carson Center in Munich, the National Endowment for Humanities, among others. And we are happy to have him here with us today to talk about his latest book, The Blue Humanities, published by Routledge in 2023. Blue Humanities is the first textbook to explore the many ways humans engage with water, utilizing literary, cultural, historical, and theoretical connections and ecologies to introduce students to the history and theory of water-centric thinking. Comprised of the multinational text and materials, such each chapter will provide readers with a range of primary and secondary sources, offering a fresh look at the major oceanic regions, saltwater and freshwater geographies, and the physical properties of water that characterize the blue humanities. Each chapter engages with carefully chosen primary texts, including frequently taught works as Herman Melville's Moby Dick, Samuel Taylor's College, Rem of the Ancient Mariner, Homer's Odyssey, and Louis Baz de Camões's Lusiades, to provide the perfect pedagogy for students to develop an understanding of blue humanities chapter by chapter. Readers will gain insight into new trends in intellectual culture and the enduring history of humanity, of humans thinking with and about water, ranging across the many coastlines of the world ocean to Pacific clouds, Mediterranean lakes, Caribbean swamps, Arctic glaciers, Southern Ocean, rainstorms, Atlantic groundwater, and Indian Ocean rivers, providing new avenues for future thinking and investigation of the blue humanities. This volume will be ideal for both undergraduate and graduate courses engaging with the environmental humanities and oceanic literature. Welcome, Steve, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Ahmed and Scott, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
It's our pleasure to have you. Can you start us off, please, by saying a few words about yourself? That is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you would like to mention any influential mentors or texts.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I grew up in the Northeast in New Jersey. I live now on the Connecticut shoreline, just a little bit northeast of New York City, sort of halfway between New York and Boston, I guess. And I do mention the bases because although this is a global book and a global project, I come to it very much through my own local experience of the North Atlantic Ocean, in particular, a little piece of Long Island Sound that is, down the street from where I live in Brantford, Connecticut. I go swimming every day in the summertime when the water's warm enough, and I think a lot about how the experience of being an ocean swimmer, affects me as a thinker and a writer and a teacher. This is a book that tries to engage with the experience of living in proximity to water. Saltwater, sort of as a kind of dominant form. Most of the water on our planet is saltwater, but also freshwater, ice, humidity in the air, water in mammalian bodies and things like that. So in terms of my academic background, I did my PhD nearby at Yale University in the late 90s. I've been teaching since the early 2000s at St. John's University in Queens. Yes, I do have a long commute, but, that is the academic life sometimes. And, in terms of influential mentors and colleagues, I mean, I feel like I've been, to borrow a bad sort of cliched metaphor, riding a wave of blue scholarship over the last couple of decades. And I've been really fortunate to get to work with people Glenn Gordonier and Eric Rurda at the Williams Mystic Institute, the Munson Institute for Maritime Studies at Mystic Seaport in Connecticut, who I was part of an NEH summer seminar with them in 2006, quite a long time ago now. And, just been really fortunate to be, engaging with a global ocean studies and water studies community from Australia to Europe to South Africa to New Zealand and many other places.
Thank you for sharing that. Before delving into the book, we would like to know where, how, and when you wrote An Introduction to Blue Humanities. Please tell us about the research and writing process.
Sure, I'm very happy to. This is a book that really comes out of the research on, water, literature, and culture that I've been doing for the last couple of decades. It is, in some sense, a culmination of a project that I began in the 2000s when I turned from doing sort of exclusively kind of literary research about prose fiction in the age of Shakespeare to looking at the relationship between water and culture, starting with the book on shipwreck, and actually even before that, a book on Shakespeare and the sea. I am one of the people that has been using this term blue humanities or sometimes blue cultural studies, among other terms that people have been using to talk about oceanic and maritime cultures. And so it sort of felt like in the early 2020s that we've had a couple of decades of this kind of work across different literary and cultural fields, including ocean history and environmental studies and ecological studies. And it sort of felt like it was time to do a volume that tried to synthesize and bring some things together, to introduce the field to new people and also to have a sense that's, going to be out of date, pretty much now that the book is finished and in a solid state, it's going to continue to be out of date because the field is changing and developing, week by week and month by month.
Yes, indeed, that's the case with all of our work.
Yes.
Can you tell us what's the essential focus of the book, An Introduction to Blue Humanity, and how does it differ from traditional approaches to studying water and sports?
Yeah, I think that the idea that I was trying to get at in this book is to try to see what kinds of continuities and connections I could draw between the different kinds of scholarship that we do about water and human culture. The structure of the book, touches on many of the different maritime basins. So there's an Atlantic, a Pacific, an Indian Ocean chapter, a chapter on the Southern Ocean, a chapter on the Caribbean, and on the Arctic Sea. But it also, at the same time, tries to stretch our more traditional sort of saltwater basin structures of thinking by also thinking about different forms of freshwater, including water in all three phases, solid water or ice, liquid water, gaseous water in the atmosphere, and also, the kinds of, water in the human body, water in clouds, water in rainfall, water in lakes and springs. And I'm really trying in this project to connect what is in some sense, I think, a long history of trying to think with oceans as geographic and cultural structures with all these different more intimate and more and varied ways in which we engage with water.
Fantastic. Kind of related to that, into the intimacy with water, one of the central contributions of this book seems to be that the Blue Humanities isn't just this emergent body of, scholarly work, this wave you said that you've been a part of and riding, but a methodology. You call it an interpretive method for research and scholarly inquiry that, as you say, links human-sized encounters to planetary processes. Mm-hmm. And you also call it a theoretical leading edge of this methodology, as you say, is embodiment. And in your case, specifically swimming, and in the case of some other scholars that you lay out in the conclusion. So could you tell us a bit more about these closer intimacies between humans and water and how they can be generative for scholars who are very often confined to the realm of archives and libraries?
Yeah, I think, thank you for that question, Scott. I think that's really helpful in bringing out one of the things that seems to me at least very distinctive about this developing body of scholarship, which is that it is, it tries as much as possible, given the limits of geography and individual circumstances and other things, to think in practice. We are all in contact with water all the time, although not everybody, is in contact with the same water. But one of the things that I try to do, and that many of the writers and thinkers and creative artists who I engage with, I think, are trying to do, is to understand the human relationship with water as really divided through both pleasure and risk, an engagement with the aesthetic and supportive elements of water as a, both a necessary quality for human life and also a kind of aesthetic and beautiful object, and also think seriously about the dangers that flooding and, forced maritime migrancy and other kinds of, destructive storm surge and other kinds of violent engagements with water both have historically had over the course of human history, and also increasingly so now in an age of sea level rise and increasingly violent storms.
I think that dialectic between pleasure and risk, or that, binary of pleasure and risk, I think is so pervasive throughout a lot of Blue Humanities scholarship for a very, good reason. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the texts that, to me, and I think to so many scholars, as you point out in the book, really captures that is Melville's Moby Dick. That section in the chapter Brit comes to my mind of, consider the subtleness of the sea.
Yep.
So, you touch on so many important texts in this book, but Melville's Moby Dick is this book's lodestar, or as you call it, its urtext. So can you tell us a little bit more about your decision to weave Moby Dick in throughout this book?
Mm-hmm.
And that centrality of Melville to Blue Humanities thinking?
Yeah, thank you. I do, one of the things that I decided to do structurally when I was setting this book up is to have a kind of Moby Dick element in every chapter. There would be other ways to do it. You could have like a core Moby Dick chapter in the book. But I thought that distributing Melville throughout was really sort of truer to my sense of the way this novel functions as a kind of shared and, a text that is both about obsession and a text that many of us in this community of scholars and writers and thinkers, it's a text about which many of us tend to be obsessive. Yeah. And really one of the reasons that Moby Dick sort of gets in my mind and doesn't get out, other than its like extraordinary qualities as a text, is this way in which I've almost never met a water person who doesn't have some particular relationship to Moby Dick. And I'm thinking here especially about non-literary water people, marine scientists and sailors and, you know, sort of people in a broader world of water connection that aren't necessarily going to read, you know, huge 19th century literary novels. And I think that Moby Dick has this it's both a very weird book and also a book that is about a shared obsession and experience that I think many people, including non-literary and non-academic people, have a relationship to. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to use it as a kind of through line or a kind of secret thread tracing through the book, is to think about what this text does for us and why it is that we're so obsessed with it.
Thank you.
And we see that across the 10 chapters of the book, which is also supplemented by an essential readings list, Blue Humanities. How does the book use literary, cultural, historical, and theoretical connections to introduce students to the concept of water-centric thinking in the Blue Humanities?
I think that thank you, Ahmed, for that question. I think that, you know, literary culture, poetic culture, narrative culture in this book serves as a kind of a test case. It's a way in which, it provides examples of the way in which humans imagine ourselves to be in physical, metaphorical, emotional, and sometimes also political contact with water. So the symbolic value of water in a novel like Moby Dick, in an epic poem like Camoens' Lusiads, and a novel like Robinson Crusoe, contemporary Caribbean literature or contemporary poetry from Oceania, we have in these representations very different kinds of relationships with water in very different forms. But we also have literature and poetics in particular serve as a kind of experimental conceptual way to sort of try out different kinds of relationships between humans and water. And really that's the attraction of literary forms for me, is their variety and experimental nature. I'm also, of course, trained as my PhD is in English literature, and I'm trained as a literary scholar. That's what I teach in my day job. But I also think that literature is particularly useful in enabling us, from an individual limited points of view, we can try out different forms of understanding how we relate to in one of the introductory chapters I call planetary water.
I think that trying out is such an important quality for scholars working, across disciplines and everywhere. Ahmed and I, before this conversation, were talking about how I'm an anthropologist, you're a literary scholar, Steve, and Ahmed's a historian, but how rubrics like the Blue Humanities allow us to kind of reach across in certain ways and draw on other disciplines in a way that we're not always encouraged to do, especially as early career researchers like Ahmed and I. And in that vein, one thing I was really impressed by in this book is how you touch on a range of kind of different scholarly worlds in these chapters. If we imagine the Mediterranean, the Black Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, the Caribbean, the Pacific Sea of Islands, as each being their own world that encompasses the literary, the historical, and have their own historiographic tradition and theoretical tendency or intellectual genealogy. So, this book is one of the first that I've seen that really synthesizes, like you said earlier in the conversation, synthesizes all of these worlds together. Like many scholars have, they touch on Brodel, or maybe they talk about Christina Sharp outside of the Atlantic, like that's very useful, or Pele Ha'ofa, all of these authors are used by many scholars in the Blue Humanities. But by putting this together, by synthesizing it into a type of, canon, for lack of a better word, what do you hope readers will get out of putting these worlds, which are often separated by these disciplinary boundaries, into conversation with one another, let's say in undergrad?
Thank you, Scott. That's a really sort of exciting prospect. I think that one thing that I certainly imagine will happen with this book is that it will not always be you know, it is true that not everybody reads a book from page one to page 100, whatever, you know, that it will be mined specifically by people who are interested in the Caribbean or the Mediterranean or the Southern Ocean or whatever. I do think, especially in the introductory chapters that are more comprehensive, and in a larger sense, in the sort of sweep of the whole project, that it tries to show ways of connection between discourses that are really distinct from each other. It is absolutely true that there's a radical difference between, you know, scholarship on, you know, classical antiquity in the Mediterranean and scholarship on indigenous poetry in the 20th century, 21st century Pacific. I mean, in many ways, those things are radically untethered to each other. And one of the animating intellectual fantasies or hopes of the Blue Humanities is that we can figure out ways to bring unlike things into conversation with each other. There is a geographical structure of this. We know that the world ocean is a single body of water, and that the water that's in the Mediterranean, the water that's in the Pacific are the same water. They're connected to each other. And there is also, while recognizing the, you know, limitations of any single person's expertise and sort of ability to master, you know, so many different highly technical and concentrated and rich areas of scholarship, there is, I think, in the project of this book, and maybe for many of us, or some of us at least, the larger project of the Blue Humanities, an idea of connection that allows for difference, celebrates difference, but also recognizes some, you know, shared similarities, shared attitudes, shared positions in relationship to a watery body that is both, you know, as we talked about before, both alluring and deadly, both risky and beautiful.
Yes, and in addition to talking about oceanic regions, the book also touches on saltwater, freshwater geographies, the very physical properties of water. So I was wondering, how does the book address the environmental humanities and its relation to oceanic literature across these chapters?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ahmed. That's an interesting way to put it. I mean, I think that I'm trying in the book. I mean, I do think of the Blue Humanities as in kind of deep contact with the oceanic, or sorry, with the environmental humanities, with the sort of broader movement in the 21st century to think culture and historical scholarship in relationship to environmental change, and particularly to the, you know, radical environmental change that we call the Anthropocene, or whatever other scene term we want to use on a given day. And I think that, like, part of my reason over the years for going back to oceanic culture in connection to thinking about the Anthropocene and the current age of environmental catastrophe is because as our environment grows less hospitable, less like the way it has been for much of human civilization, the environment is becoming more and more oceanic. This is, like, literally true in the sense that sea level is rising and water is going in places we haven't been expecting it to go. And I think it's also metaphorically true because in human culture's shared reservoir of stories and poems and ideas about humanity and nature, so many of our most resonant stories about a hostile environment have to do with things like with maritime culture, have to do with the experience of being at sea, either, you know, alone like a shipwrecked sailor, or even at sea in a community under threat. And so the stories that the Blue Humanities enables us to think about are stories about an environment that is hostile, you know, not so hostile that everybody dies instantly. It's not an apocalypse story, but it's a story about needing to struggle in an environment that makes things difficult for you.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
The last thing you want to hear when you need your auto insurance most is,
"Thank you for calling. Please listen to your list of 46 possible service options."
Which is why when you choose USAA auto insurance, you'll get great service that is easy and reliable. 24/7 online service for claims, access to roadside assistance, and more. All at the touch of a button. Start getting the service you deserve. Get a quote today. USAA. Ability to receive a quote depends on membership eligibility. Membership eligibility and product restrictions apply and are subject to change. USAA means United Services Automobile Association and its affiliate, San Antonio, Texas.
And I think that those stories are especially relevant to the current situation of the environmental, for the environment and the environmental humanities.
You know, I think obviously we're right now, you know, this week, last week,
right,
in a moment where all of this feels so urgent.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, there are those of us in the environmental humanities who have, you know, those of us who were even before I was born, you know, who've been talking about this urgency, but right now it feels like we're hitting another fever in the Anthropocene, or like you said, whatever we want to call it. But I do want to kind of ask you, in terms of, you know, I see your work, Steve, as being a large part of this blue humanities and oceanic thinking, but then you also contribute to this conversation on the Anthropocene. And it's something that, you know, I think we can talk about the specifics of the term, or, you know, I'm just curious, where do you see the blue humanities as fitting in, as complementing that conversation on the Anthropocene, capitalocene, plantationocene, you know, like you say, the many scenes, or as being something separate and something that helps us, you know, build toward a shared understanding? You know, how do you see these two kind of, because I see them as almost distinct bodies of, if I'm talking to some scholars about the Anthropocene, the blue humanities might not be legible to them. So how do we, you know, put these in conversation with one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I do think that these, I mean, you're right on some basic level, of course, that like Anthropocene discourse and water discourse are like, they touch each other, but, you know, the Venn diagram is not overlapping. But as I was just saying a minute ago, I think that one of the things that blue humanities water studies can give to the Anthropocene is a recognition of the presence in human cultural history of, a series of engagements with the hostile environment. I recognize, you know, like this was the hottest week on record as far as back as the records go, or maybe it was the week before last, I'm not sure. It was maybe the first week of July, but, you know, the sense, the overwhelming sense from the science that we're like entering novel territory, that we've never been in this place before. And there's like absolute, you know, scientific and you know, sort of technical accuracy to all of those, all of those observations. And I don't want to downplay them. I think they're incredibly important as motivating structures. But I also think that the one thing that thinking with water can remind us is that we have a long history as humans of understanding our relationship to a hostile environment. And like sometimes I wrote in years ago in the sort of beginning of this project for me, I wrote about the difference between sailors and swimmers on the one hand and like emperors and warriors on the other, right? That there's this long history of like the dominating masculine hero figure. And alongside that, in a slightly different and maybe in some sense lower key, there are these figures who aren't necessarily dominating in the same way, or not in the same kind of violent way, but are sort of figuring out how to manage in a hostile environment. Obviously, in lots of cases, we have characters who are like alternately one and the other. Like Odysseus, for example, is both a, you know, violent dominator of humans when he has the chance, and also a good swimmer and sailor when he is forced into that situation. And so I think that the narratives and understandings of relationship with a hostile environment that can be surfaced by the blue humanities are particularly valuable in an age in which there's both more water around and also just more environmental hostility around than perhaps we've been used to.
Yeah. You know, I think it is a great, you know, way to, for example, like, you know, I was kind of gesturing or asking at before, thinking with undergrads about, let's say, Melville, the idea that Noah's flood has never ended, you know, a hostile environment, or thinking with Coleridge and the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and the nature of ice, you know, the nature of ice on the ropes, or the nature of, you know, killing nature in that sense of the albatross. So, you know, I think in a lot of senses, it's that timeliness, like you say, that long history of living in hostile environments that feels, you know, if we're reading the news, it feels so contemporary, but it has this long historical and literary tradition that is, I think, accessible to many students. So,
yeah, I think so. And I think also accessible, like, to the extent that Coleridge and Melville are accessible, and I think they can be and sometimes are, but also accessible to people who, like, you know, living through the heat waves of this summer and the, you know, the big storms of the last decade in various parts, various parts of the world. Like, I think we recognize hostile environments driven by water that feels, from a human sense, out of place, whether it's like storm surge, you know, coming into your neighborhood, or, you know, flooding in your basement or whatever. Like, we recognize something about the experience of being in an environment that's super saturated by water in ways that feel really destructive and actually are destructive to, to human thriving, or at least human ease, maybe.
Yes, indeed. And I would like to ask you about embodiment and phenology, and how did you from that? And I know you talk about that in different venues and writing and thinking about blue humanities.
Embodiment and chronology, did you say?
In drawing from your own experiential, let's say, relationship with water, and shaping your thinking of blue humanities.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure I understood the question. So, one of the things that I often do when I'm working out any kind of academic or para-academic, you know, sort of watery project, is if I'm thinking about something, I will, take it for a swim. I will, you know, one of the nice things about swimming is that nobody can send you an email or even like get your attention very easily because your head is down in the water. And so I use it as a kind of meditative practice to think about ideas and language and the kinds of ideas and the forms of language that I want to use. So embodiment is really important to me as a writer, as a swimmer, as a, you know, thinking human. And I'm also really influenced, as I think many people in our blue humanities community are, by the work of a student of mine, the feminist eco-philosopher, who's now based in Canada. In her book, Bodies of Water, she thinks about the relationship between, you know, bodies of water like lakes and oceans and rivers and streams, but also bodies of water, including human bodies. And she provides a kind of feminist rereading of material embodiment through watery connection that for many people, I think, in this discourse very much, including me, has been, you know, deeply inspiring and incredibly useful and applicable in the way that, you know, we in academic culture sometimes find ideas that feel so rich that they're like too good not to move them into other discourses. And so I think a lot about embodiment through Astrida's way of sort of building out eco-feminist phenomenology. But also, so there is both an intellectual genealogy question way to answer that, and also an experiential one.
I echo that, and I find it to be the best way to clear up my head and when I my writing more than I would say walking or working out or other activities. Thank you for sharing that. You supplement the book with essential readings list, and I'm wondering what was the criteria in selecting these readings, and do you have stories or connections or experiences you would like to share about these readings?
Yeah, I mean, I went back and forth on this, and I, you know, you don't want it to be. I was looking for, again, thinking about this book as a book of introduction, that someone could come to this who was an undergraduate or an early stage graduate student, or even, you know, a researcher in a cognate field who just want to know what this whole business of the blue humanities is about. So I want it to be fairly comprehensive in the sense of trying to give a sense of the different discursive currents and flows that are moving from different parts of the world, different, you know, scholarship that comes out of Black studies, out of Indigenous studies, out of Mediterranean and Pacific studies. And I also didn't want to just duplicate the, you know, the bibliography that's right before it in the book. So I tried in the essential reading, which is ended up being too big to be like a provisional course syllabus, right? You could never read all these books in that semester, even if you're like really driving your graduate students hard. But it is a little bit of a portrait, a snapshot as of, you know, 2022 when I was putting this together, a snapshot of where the discourse has been in the last, you know, dozen or 15 years or so. I tried mostly to include things that had been published quite recently, so the late teens or the early 20s. And I also limited myself to just one book per author. So I, you know, there's lots of people on that list who have written, you know, multiple really interesting things that people use in this discourse. But I also tried to just sort of, you know, limit myself to one representative work from each figure on the list. I also, like, you know, as it's always true, like when you make a list like this, you always think about the things that get left off of it, and even the things that have come out since this book was in press that I couldn't include on it. And so I wouldn't want this list to be seen as like, I mean, someone, I can't remember which one of you it was, mentioned the word canon before. And I think, like a lot of literary scholars, I have a kind of aversion to the word canon as a as an exclusionary device traditionally in literary studies. And I both recognize the need to gather together something like a, you know, common shared reading list, but also I'm quite like, I would want all lists like this to be infinitely revisable, both because there's new stuff coming out and also because the ways in which new scholarship and emerging scholarship in this field is going to ask us to reconsider, you know, elements of the history of the last 20 years of blue humanities scholarship that are not immediately apparent to me right now, but will be apparent to someone else in 5 years or 10 years.
That sounds awesome.
I was just going to say, it's really exciting, and I think it's a great resource, Steve. So thank you for compiling it.
It is very.
Thank you. I'm glad.
And I would like to see an annual update for the list, maybe somewhere on your website.
Well, you know, actually, there are two big public Zotero bibliographies. This was one of the things when I was first starting this book, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to keep track of all this stuff? Like in some ways, like you could almost like, you know, every couple weeks, it seems like there's new publications in these broad fields. And like, there's no way, I mean, because of the way book publishing works, you know, it's not instantaneous. I submitted the manuscript in November of 22. And it just came out a couple of weeks ago. So even in that window, there's been a lot of publications. But there are two public Zotero bibliographies, one for the blue humanities and the other for, I think it's termed coastal history. It might be coastal history / ocean history. And they're absolutely fantastic, and they're constantly being updated. So that does exist. I mean, the shorter version, the essential reading that I put in the book is just a, you know, it's 30 odd text as opposed to, I think the coastal history is up to 200 or 300 and the blue humanities one is about 150. So this is just a little slice out of that, but these larger public, you know, collaborative bibliographies are a thing in the world right now. And I definitely, you know, I mentioned them in the book and I recommend them to people as well.
I'm glad that you brought it up, and I, would like listeners to go and take it out and contribute to this great project.
Mm-hmm.
You've titled the book as an introduction. And when I see the word introduction on the title, I find the book to be not intimidating, welcoming, and easy read. So who is the intended audience for this book? Who would you like it, to take it and read it and engage with it? And how would you like that to be?
Yeah, I mean, I very much intend this book to be, as I think we mentioned a little bit earlier, to be it's for people who are not, you know, like in some ways, all the people who are close into the center of this field, like will find a lot of stuff in here they already know. But so this is designed to expand the circle of the blue humanities, if you will, people who are interested broadly in, you know, some aspects of maritime literature. Maybe they occasionally teach Melville or The Tempest or something like that. And they'd like to connect themselves to this broader conversation about water and human culture. So it is for teachers, it is for students at all levels, undergraduate and, you know, master's students, doctoral students. It's also for practitioners and creative artists. I've been incredibly inspired and amazed by how many, you know, artists of different kinds in the contemporary world are working with water in different ways, and in conceptual art, in visual art, in narrative artists, filmmakers. That there's an incredible body of creative work that's dealing with sort of ocean adjacency or ocean intimacy or water intimacy, I might say. And I would love to have those people also, you know, dip into this book, even if they're not necessarily, professorally inclined. Maybe I'll just mention one other thing, which is the cover of the book is a sort of sunrise photo that I took of my local beach, with, you know, a picture. It has a little picture of a cormorant and a boat and a couple of swimming buoys and a couple islands and a sailboat on the horizon. And it's very local in this sense, right? It's a picture that I take almost every morning when I get up and take the dogs out and go to the beach with them. And so I very much feel like this is a project that I've taken so much from my local community, from the lands and waters of Short Beach, Connecticut, from the human and non-human collaborators in my sort of swimming and beachcombing culture. And I do also think of this as a book that is, it's mainly for academics who are going to read it. In a weird way, it's also for that cormorant who's sitting there on the surface of the water, just about to go down after another fish. And it is my attempt to bring to bear the skills that I have, that I've learned to have as a professor and a writer and a scholar, to reflect back to the oceanic world, the watery world, a little bit of the kinds of things that some of us are trying to conceptualize and produce in dialogue with that larger planetary water body.
Yes, and I hope the also scholars from different disciplines dare to pick up the book and try to engage with it, because the book does invite the different disciplines to think through blue humanities about their different approaches and mythologies. I told a friend of mine that I'm going to talk to you about your book today, and he told me that this sounds like, I don't know if you know this novel called The Covenant of Water by Abraham Verghese that came out recently, last May, and your book just came out, and he's like, oh, this book is the Oppenheimer to the Barbie.
I don't know that book, but it's always nice to be mentioned in the same breath as Barbenheimer, I guess, although I didn't see any movies this past weekend.
I would recommend that. It was a really good novel to think also about water. It is that, I guess, and hopefully end of the summer. Now the book is out, and I know it's just being out. Mm-hmm. We like to know about your current and future projects, if you would like to, I would, the listeners.
Sure, I will. I mean, it will maybe surprise no one after hearing about this book. That I have another sort of Melville adjacent project in the works, and it's really kind of a weird one. It started as sort of a private project, and I've eventually brought it into press and should be out next year. which is a book of poems called Sailing Without Ahab, which indulges in the fantasy that what we really need is a version of Moby Dick without Ahab, without the tyrannous, obsessive, violent, destructive, white male captain. Instead, we have a kind of fluid, you know, Ishmael-driven wander through the, you know, the through the world ocean and through the, you know, particular kinds of engagements with, you know, with marine creatures, including the white whale, but also with, you know, different kinds of maritime environments. So what it is, it's a, as I said, it's a bit of a weird project. It's a book of 137 poems, one for each chapter of Moby Dick. And the only sort of required structure is that you can't mention the name of the captain. So in a couple of cases, there's a bracket with some ellipses in the middle of it in which that four-letter word would have appeared. And it's, you know, partly an exercise in kind of hyper-gross literary criticism, in which I go back to this novel that has been important to me for many, many decades, and also an effort to think, I mean, because it's also partly an autobiographical book, and it thinks about, you know, my experience of the land and water that I live near, and how engaging with it, swimming in it, being alongside it has been important to sort of shape my thinking about ecology and human experience. So coming in the spring.
As a consumer of all things Melville, I can't wait to read it.
I hope you enjoy it.
We look forward to that and maybe have you again on the podcast. This has been...
Wow, that would be fun. That would be terrific. Yes. I would enjoy it.
Thank you for joining us, Steve, today and talking about your fabulous new book, An Introduction to Blue Humanities. And thank you for Scott Eric for co-hosting this episode with me. And thank you for the listeners for tuning in to listen to today's episode, in which we explored An Introduction to the Blue Humanities, published by Routledge in 2023. This is your host, Ahmed El-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.